Welcome to Your Money Today, a unique look at financial, geopolitical, and other news relevant to you. For 45 years now, your host, Chris Temple, has provided his one-of-a-kind insights and advice on the markets and on our world. Whatever the subject, he calls them like he sees them. Roll up your sleeves with Chris as we get into today's program.
Welcome back, everybody. It's hard to believe it's been a little over a month since I've done an episode of Your Money Today. As always, I'm on everybody else's shows, it seems, and I trust you've seen all of those in the recent past. This is going to be a compilation of some of those thoughts. It's also going to look toward the back half of the year, which is quite likely to be as eventful or more compared to what we've already seen. There are two major topics or subjects or themes, whatever you want to call them, as we make the turn and head to the back half of 2026. Of course, number one is the Warsh Fed, and I'll have a lot to say individually on that subject. And secondly is what is going to go on in the end with the Iran war. I mean, we've had war and peace and war and peace and more peace deals, and we're up to some 40-some peace deals now, or peace announcements that never materialize or last very long. And right now, of course, as I'm recording this on the weekend of July 11th and 12th, we have new hostilities going on. President Trump has basically said, and look, this is after he wanted a peace deal, and incredibly, as he admitted a while back, and I pointed this out, as did other people, he admitted that if this war went on a whole heck of a lot longer, we're going to have a global recession, we're going to have a major energy crisis, we'd even start running out of a lot of products here in the U.S. When it comes to energy. And I think we've all been lulled into a false sense of security with a lot of manipulation that's gone on in the energy markets. I'll be talking about that, of course, as we go along. So we have those new hostilities. We don't know where things are going to go. All we can do is look, as I've said many times, at probabilities, whether it's the energy markets, the stock market, commodities, or whatever the case may be. So we're going to talk about those two subjects chiefly. We're also going to talk about the stock market and kind of a third major subject, I guess you'd say, is the fact that the stock market has still managed to hang in there for quite a while now, despite everybody's concerns or a lot of people's concerns about a bubble, about how things will deteriorate if we really aren't going to see an end to the Iran war. And I, for one, and those of you who have followed me and listened to my comments on others' shows, know that I've been skeptical all along that this is going to end peaceably or end well. And there's a lot of reasons for that that we've discussed. The big one, and I have to repeat this, and it bears repeating, is that there's so much going on, and I'll especially talk about this with the challenges that Kevin Warsh has. There's so much going on in the economy right now that looks like a lot of things are ready to break. And we want to be able to have a scapegoat to point to say, boy, if it weren't for this, we'd have been okay. But look at what those terrible Persians did in causing this crisis and causing the markets debacles that if they come and all that kind of thing. And if I've said it once, I've said it a million times. On September the 10th, 2001, we were already in a recession. We were already in a bear market on Wall Street. The narrative on September 10th that had been building for quite a while was, number one, that Alan Greenspan, who recently left this mortal plane, was mortal after all. And that not only was he no longer being viewed as the maestro, but now he's a screw up because he's the one that caused the bubble that was losing its air and then the resulting recession. And a lot of people revisiting his stewardship of the Fed specifically and the Fed and monetary policy generally. Along for the ride was George W. Bush, who happened to be sworn in at a lousy time because all of these things were already to hit the fan. And he was under fire because he didn't seem to know what to do about it and kind of in over his head, et cetera. That was the narrative on September the 10th. The next day, September the 11th, we had the attacks in New York City and elsewhere, those presumably elsewhere. We won't get into all of those various theories about what happened or didn't happen, but for present purposes, the point is this, that after September the 11th, when the stock market's decline worsened, when the recession worsened, these things were no longer being laid at the feet, as they properly were prior, of Alan Greenspan primarily, and maybe George Bush and our policymakers and lawmakers secondarily. Now all of these things were the fault of 19 terrorists. Keep that in the back of your mind as the summer unfolds and we see how things shake out. You know, President Trump, so much anymore is like the boy who cried wolf. The threats hardly mean anything anymore. The promises hardly mean anything. A lot of the manipulation of the news does because it's caused some outsized moves in the stock market and energy markets primarily for a while now. But, you know, this weekend, as I'm recording this, we have this notion that there's an assassination plot against Trump. Well, if I get killed, I want Iran flattened, kind of thing. And similar threats that have been thrown against them. So, look, this is a mess of our own making as a country for all the reasons we've been talking about since this war started. And again, not that we can hang our hat on any one scenario, we have to look at probabilities. But especially when I get to talk about the energy markets, a lot of the dies has already been cast. The dies have already been cast. As far as what is going to happen going forward with energy, it's not a pretty picture. Initially, it's going to lead to much worse inflation problems, even if we stayed where we're at right now with the crude oil price in the markets, because that, as you'll hear, does not reflect reality on the ground. It doesn't reflect reality for diesel prices globally, for gasoline prices globally, for other utility needs for gas globally. And besides Iran, of course, what's going on there, we've seen Ukraine knock out about a third of Russia's refining capacity. That's going to ripple through Europe and make a bad situation worse, particularly with natural gas and things like that. So we're really in a mess. And this is at a time when there's a lot of other cracks starting to appear. Before I start with the first big subject, and that is Kevin Warsh and the Fed, a quick little commercial message for those of you who are our members at the National Investor. I will be sharing in the days ahead following this video some graphics and art and so forth that comport with some of these topics. And to get this out the door, I'm just sticking to a video version right now, which is a lot easier. And in any event, most of you who ever make your views known to me rather would listen to a podcast and sit down and watch a video on a computer anyway. So that's what we'll tilt toward this time. But I will have some graphics and charts and things, which I'll kind of narrate a little bit as I need to as we go along right here. But that said, this week, Kevin Warsh will be in front of both the House and Senate Finance Committees, the semi-annual Fed head talks. In front of Congress, which us old timers still refer to as the Humphrey Hawkins testimony, named for the two legislators, of course, who created this mandate for the Fed chair back in the 70s. And it'll be interesting to see what Mr. Warsh has to say. Regrettably, and we already know this, of course, from past experience in recent years, most of the questions are inane and stupid, not of a serious nature. And whether they come from Republicans or Democrats, either one, they're more about bloviating and trying to come up with sound bites for election or re-election campaigns, is, you know, rather than they are serious about Fed policy. Maybe we'll get a few, of course. We'll see what happens. And as always, if anything noteworthy comes, of course, I'll share it with our membership. But that said, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time belaboring this because I've said this numerous times since way back in January when President Trump first nominated Warsh, you need to brace yourself for a two-act Kevin Warsh. All right. Act one, as he has made abundantly clear, is that his first job, and he has staked his entire reputation and the success of his chairmanship on this unmistakably. Job one is to get price stability back under the Fed's control. Jerome Powell lost that. Inflation expectations among consumers and businesses are at the highest they've been in a while. And, the Fed chairman is going to have to act tough and to back up his tough talk. Now, no question that he would rather have nature take its course in the markets, have the deflationary and economic weakening aspects of the global energy shock and some other things that'll maybe do some of his work for him. But make no mistake, if they have to, by probably September, the Fed will start to raise interest rates here and there, hopefully, in his mind, get away with just one or two rate hikes so that they don't have to throw the economy more so into recession in order to try and get inflation under control. The second act, of course, afterwards, is that he is going to be a transformational figure where the system is concerned. I've talked many times, and it bears repeating, about Paul Volcker, who he will follow in pattern, maybe not in degree, of course, it would be difficult to do that under present circumstances, but in pattern, where Paul Volcker came in the late 70s, whipped inflation, by most appearances, even at the cost of a recession. But then his second act, which ended up being far more important in the grand scheme of things, was that he came up with a whole modern day phenomenon of the wealth effect and really goosing money supply growth to enable ever higher debts, way worse than what he inherited. But if he could create that inflation in the monetary system and have it directed into asset prices like stocks and real estate and business valuations and more, the trickle-down effect, the wealth effect of that, will help the economy. So he kind of turned the natural order upside down, and that's his legacy. I've talked about that many, many times. Warsh's second act is going to be a bit different than that, but here again, the goal of it will be to enable ever more debt creation and to manage the present debt loads without having everything go off the rails. Now, that's their theory. The math is still very much against them, as I've said many times. We're seeing bond markets around the world under stress. We're seeing capital markets under increasing stress under the surface. And what Warsh is going to have to figure out how to do is to get inflation going back in the right direction, hopefully without upsetting the apple cart. And then once he does that, they'll be able to unveil some other things. Now, I've alluded to this recently, but the annual meeting, which I'm sure most all of you have heard of, that the Kansas City Fed hosts, it's held out in Jackson, Wyoming, at the end of the summer. Somewhat facetiously call it the central bankers' end of summer picnic that they have and get together and dazzle everyone with their respective intelligence and so forth. But sometimes there's a point to it. Sometimes the Jackson Hole meeting on the part of the Fed is a place where new policies are unveiled that mean something. Not every year. But this year, interestingly, the theme is exactly following what Warsh's ultimate second act is going to be. The theme this year is financial innovation and its implications for payments and policy. Well, what does financial innovation mean? I've said this before. The reason why Treasury Secretary Bessent convinced the president to select Kevin Warsh when he on paper was the farthest thing from the kind of Fed chairman people thought Trump was going to get, where he wanted just a yes man and somebody who would be pliable and lower interest rates without question and so forth. But the reason why Warsh was selected is that he has been one of the early architects of the whole stablecoin regimen. And I'll be talking about this more as the summer goes on, and probably after that for that matter. But they are looking, and that's interesting that they immediately after his ascendance to the chairmanship, that that's the theme of the Jackson meeting this year. But they're going to be looking at stable coins and certain other things to try and come up with some newfangled monetary regimen, which will help, really, in the end, extend and pretend the current, you know, never-ending deficit and debt regimen that we have right now. Near term, what's half comical about what Warsh says he wants to do, and maybe in the end we'll figure out a way to accomplish with this whole regime that they're going to eventually come up with, he has said correctly, in my opinion, that the Fed should not be as heavy a presence in the markets and the economy as it has become. And of course, again, that was the regimen that Paul Volcker began. And that successive Fed chairs, Alan Greenspan most notably, made worse institutionally, and then Jerome Powell just went nutso on money printing and making the Fed the be-all and end-all of everything. He correctly wants to dial that back. And at the same time, he believes that the strength of the U.S. economy, the productivity gains of AI in particular, will lead to non-inflationary growth and allow, in the end, for eventually interest rates to be cut once inflation is back under control, hopefully without causing a big bust in the process. What's interesting is that Warsh right now, in his early days, is presiding over the exact opposite of what he says he wants in the end. The Fed's balance sheet is expanding. It's grown over $300 billion so far in 2026. Warsh himself, after his first FOMC meeting recently, reiterated that even though they're going to have a more hawkish view near term to try and bring, in, you know, at least talk inflation down, if not have to act to bring it down a little bit, at the same time, he reiterated what Jerome Powell did do at the end of last year, and that is to pretty much make open-ended the New York Fed's open market operations and whatever they've got to do to paper over problems in the economy, and more so in the credit markets, they'll do it. And there are problems in the credit markets. That's another thing that Warsh has got that's going to temper his ability to try and rein inflation back in, because across the board you've seen things like everybody from Goldman Sachs to UBS to some other firms in recent months having stress in their private equity funds, in real estate funds, particularly where commercial mortgages are concerned. And there's a lot of cracks underneath the surface that, and this is why, and some of you have seen this cartoon that Jerry King did for me, our cartoonist, where Warsh is kind of in the middle, and, you know, does he bow to the bond market vigilantes and get tough on inflation and raise interest rates if he needs to? Or does he forget about that and say, okay, well, I can't allow everything to go bust, so we'll just, you know, like the old, the late Richard Russell would say, we'll just inflate or die. He'll do that later, but he needs to worry about inflation near term. And so, again, speaking of the near term, I think what the markets are still pretty much whistling past this graveyard on is that Warsh is serious. His first job is to put the bond market vigilantes back on the sidelines. And if there is a choice that he has to make now for the near term purposes of risking a recession, risking a comeuppance in the financial markets, but to galvanize the dollar, to galvanize the treasury market, and to make sure things don't get any worse there, he's going to do that rather than continuing to allow inflation to run. And that, I think, is a risk, among others, going into the second half of the year, is that the treasury market gets this. They realize that inflation is still a major problem. I'll talk about that in just a second. They realize that the ever-growing debt in the U.S. is still a problem, although everybody's in the same boat, you know, in other countries, of course. And of all the major asset classes, really, I think the precious metals in the recent past have understood this as well. They have, and I've said this repeatedly of late, they've behaved more than any other asset class the way they should, given the environment that we're in right now. The stock market's the one that's kind of out to lunch right now and still is not taking war seriously. And so what we want to watch, and wrapping up this particular vein of thought over the coming weeks and several months, is at what point does the war Fed say the right thing or actually act to put actions behind its words to finally get the complacency out of the financial market that, holy cow, this guy isn't kidding. And he doesn't care if he causes a way overdue correction in a way overvalued stock market. He needs to get inflation under control. So I think that's going to bear a lot of watching. And folks, let's be clear. I mean, the inflation situation right now is way worse than the average pundit, the average economist, the average guru understands. The inflation rate, and I've repeated this again many times, we were already going in the wrong direction before the Iran war started. Now it's going to be much worse going forward. And as for a lot of the monetary reasons and whatnot that were already baked into the cake, way too much money supply all around the world. That's the reason why a lot of other countries have already started raising interest rates, hoping they don't break something in the process to try and at least rein this in a little bit. That's why the Fed is likely going to do this same thing, as I said, by the fall. But look, we've got a situation where, look at China, and I want to use them as an example for this and a couple other things, perhaps, as we go along here. China, for a lot of years, was exporting deflation to the rest of the world. What's happening now? They've got a terrible problem with deflation within their own country, and the only way to help themselves get out of it is to start inflating again, to start more money flow again. How do you do that? You raise prices to your customers. You don't lower prices and try and undercut everybody, and generally speaking at least. So we have seen a situation recently because of a lot of monetary aspects and because of this war where prices being paid by the U.S. are going up. I said this on a couple other podcasts recently I was a guest on. If you look at the last 2 months that we have numbers for, import prices are rising at an annualized rate of over 20% per year, folks. A lot of you, I'm sure, have already noticed that as you've been shopping. Over 20% per year. Why is that? China, among others, has already made very clear that because of their increased costs for shipping, where shipping rates are as high as they've been in a long time, they're up something like 80% since the start of this war. Those are all going to get passed on. President Trump's on-again, off-again tariffs that are now on again, those are raising prices, contrary to what he tries to claim, that nobody pays these tariffs. Well, yes, we do. Look at import prices and look at the prices at the grocery store. So look, this is a mess. I may have said this already. You know, if you look at the last Treasury auction this past week, you had the highest yields in 20 years for the paper that Uncle Sam has to sell to finance the debt. So none of this is going in the right direction. And this here again is why Warsh is going to err on the side of, maybe in the end, for as fragile as everything is these days, overdoing it and finally causing the recession that has been overdue for a while, causing the correction in the markets that's been overdue for a while. So that's the dilemma that he's in right now. A curious part of all of this, though, and this I'm going to be talking about separately later in the summer, is the way in which the whole Iran war and a lot of other stuff similar to it from the Trump administration, particularly where Venezuela is concerned, has really been geared toward reinforcing the dollar regimen in the world, and especially the petrodollar regimen still in the Middle East. Now, I think in the end, this is going to be fighting a losing battle because history is not on the side of the U.S. where this is concerned. And I think that a lot of the fallout of what's gone on recently will cause the rest of the world incrementally to start moving away from the dollar, coming up with alternative payment regimens, etc. But this is another thing where this Warsh and Bessent tag team right now, and they don't always come out and say it in these terms, although Bessent did this recently when it came to the dollar, which astonished a lot of people. I shared that when he said this. They are looking right now to make sure that the U.S. fiscal position, its ability to finance debt without interest rates just going nuts, and its ability to enforce the dollar as much as we can still get away with. These are all things that are front and center. And even though their purported boss, President Trump, only cares about the stock market, and of course, it's a whole story, which if the Democrats win in the fall, will be investigated ad nauseum starting next year. Even though the president only worries about the stock market and goosing it, Bessent and Warsh have got bigger fish to fry in the grand scheme of things. And they know that with inflation being unleashed as it's been, that they have got to rein in the damage that that is going to do to the fiscal situation, to the bond market, etc. So again, I'll close with that, on this subject at least, by saying that don't underestimate how much these guys see this as the biggest urgency, not keeping the stock market afloat, but making sure that the U.S. does not deteriorate as far as the globe's reserve currency, which it still is, starting to fall behind everybody else. And that's why I remain on the stock market and other things bearish going forward. All right, now let's discuss energy a bit, the other major topic, at least right now, that's going to impact everything over the balance of the year besides what the Fed says and or does. Look, I've reminded a few people recently that the market-oriented price, and a lot of people use a euphemism, paper price, of crude oil recently has borne little resemblance to reality on the ground. The best example in my career that I can think of offhand is you can go back to late 2007 when the market was bubbly, commodities were bubbly and so forth, and then within a year after that, late in the fall of 2008, everything collapsed. And in well under a year's time, the paper price in the market of a barrel of oil went from what is still a record of $147 a barrel in 2007 down to 30 something a barrel. Neither of those numbers reflected the real world. These were speculators that went way to one side of the boat this time, and then on the other end, way to the other side of the boat. So the supply and demand factors for oil were not themselves that extreme, anywhere near that extreme. But that's what speculation in the markets does when you've got people that are front running, one direction or the other for oil. So we've seen that again recently. And a lot of people have been very confused. The Economist on its front cover recently had kind of a mea culpa. We were wrong about the oil price because they and everybody else were looking at what the actual facts are on the ground in economies where refined products are concerned and saying, wait a minute, how is it that the crude price has come down from over $100 to, the 70s right now as I'm recording this, when crack spreads are the highest they've ever been? If you look at crack spreads, and I won't get into all the details of what that exactly means, but those are margins where, refiners create diesel or gasoline or jet fuel or whatever. And if you look at crack spreads, they suggest a much more stress as far as supply. And oil in the market should be still over $100 based on this. Yours truly and a lot of other people have already been pointing out how stressed the market is because of all of the damage that's been done in the Iran war. That's not going to be fixed for a number of months, if not in some cases for years, even if for the 40-something time President Trump is right and we are going to have peace, which I'm skeptical about today, as I've been this entire time. That's a different subject, and I share a lot about that, of course, on a daily basis for those of you in our audience. You know, and here's one of the reasons why I say that, and this again, and I go back to my comment at the beginning about how I compared the present time, potentially, and I would love to be proven wrong, but I figure I would be proven correct, is similar to 2001 and how we ended up with a scapegoat to blame of existing problems for, economically and market-wise and otherwise. But look, the Marco Rubio came out and basically has said, not for the first time, that the goal of the U.S. right now is to get us back to the status quo before the war is done, to kind of boil it all down. They want the Strait of Hormuz open again. They don't want tolls. They don't want Iran and Oman or whoever to have any ability to charge people to dictate who goes through and when. And, you know, that's the situation we had before the war started, of course, as we all know. And this is a very ticklish situation because everybody is understanding now just how dire the situation is if things don't get back somewhere near normal sooner rather than later. I mean, President Trump himself, as we all saw, when almost a month ago now, he first announced, you know, this memorandum of understanding to stop the hostilities, which, you know, has been pretty well useless, obviously, up to this point, as we've seen in recent days. But he even admitted that we're not far from a global recession and a much greater, longer-term hit to growth and to the energy markets because of the shock, because of the infrastructure damage and everything else. But I want to point out especially comments that General Jack Keane, who's a retired general, he's a Fox News analyst, he said this last weekend on Fox News, and incredibly, he quoted almost word for word Russia's Dmitry Medvedev, who is basically Vladimir Putin's right-hand man, for all practical purposes, kind of a vice presidential type or figure over there. And Medvedev said when he was attending the Ayatollah's funeral several days ago that Iran is in a very strong position right now because, for all practical purposes, they don't need a nuclear weapon in a stricter, literal sense of the term, because their control now overflows in and out of the Strait of Hormuz and itself is a nuclear weapon. Medvedev said that, and Jack Keane repeated that. Now, Jack Keane repeated it because he's one of the war hawks that wants President Trump to finish off Iran. You know, finish this off. We got ourselves in this mess. We can't back out gracefully. And if we want to gain control of things, this is their thinking, folks. We need to finish them off. And I mean, there's still all of these suggestions that the president's going to go in with boots on the ground. We're going to take Kerch Island. We're not going to let Iran get away with all that they're doing, etc. So this, again, and I would love to be proven wrong on this. I fear I won't be proven wrong. Look, we've got a situation where these hostilities aren't going to go away right away. And the question here on this subject, as we go into the back half of the year, is that at what point is the paper market for crude oil revealed as misleading, manipulated, as we've all seen, and prices revert to a more honest level, which would cause a renewed shock to most other asset classes, particularly the stock market, which is already of the view, just like the stock market's of the view that the Fed's going to cut interest rates any minute. I'm maybe overstating that a little bit now. They're also of the view that, oh, we don't need to worry about Iran anymore. Oil is back down and everything's going to end well. Well, what if it doesn't end well? You know, and I am very concerned about this whole thing. And the energy situation being again revealed is worse than the consensus is right now. The only good thing that the market has going for it right now, frankly, is that China for a while has pretty much stopped buying oil. It's already been well reported that they had built up such a surplus of oil in their stockpiles for a while that when we did have that initial spike in a price, it wasn't sustainable in this sense because China was able to take a break from buying. You know, why buy oil at $110 or $20 a barrel? Or in some cases, it was more than that in some Asian markets, as you may remember early on in this war, when they had something like 1.5 billion barrels in their strategic reserve, 5 or 6 times what the U.S. has right now, and we're a bigger consumer. They were able to just take a break from buying and let the market settle back down and then think about what they're going to do afterwards. So that, and that's transitory, to use a bad word, where it was used by the Fed a while back. So that has taken the edge off things and made things maybe less bad than they would have been. And the other thing, and I take this with a grain of salt, but the IEA, of course, as some of you may have seen, came out this year and said, or this week rather, and said that 2026 will be the first year since 2020 where globally daily oil demand does drop a bit. But again, I don't think that that's going to overwhelm the structural damage to the supply situation that's been done in this war. So bottom line here, folks, is I think that generally speaking, unless we had a major cataclysmic event in the market that caused deflation fears everywhere, that this oil price right now, natural gas both, I think are not going to hold up, and I would be betting on both of them. I'll be talking about this in a much nearer future for our members in the National Investor, but the stock market right now, to focus on it for just a bit, and I'll try not to belabor this. Look, I don't think that there's very many people who don't acknowledge that we have a bubble. The question is, what event or what shock or what set of circumstances will cause that bubble to finally start losing some air? I've mentioned this a few times in the recent past, but Ray Dalio, very successful investor, really smart guy, I think has put this better than anybody that I've heard articulate it, and that is this. Of course, anybody that with half of a brain, at my saying, not his necessarily, but pretty close, understands that we're in a bubble. I mean, if you look at the Shiller P.E. ratio, Warren Buffett's measure of total stock market cap versus GDP, etc., we're as high as we've ever been. I mean, it's just as extreme as in 1929 and 2000 and 2007, etc., especially 2000. And a lot of people like the 2000 comparison more so because that was another time like the present where you had a new technology that really was a major tailwind and goosing everything. Those type of stocks in those days, the internet, the fiber optic companies, all of those different kind of things were the ones leading the charge in the late 90s. They all ended up blowing up. I mean, Cisco Systems, which is a great company, they were one of the darlings back then. They were nosebleed high. Cisco, which is a Cadillac of a company today, dropped 90% from top to bottom when everything crashed back then. So you can have extremes that eventually have a reckoning. The question is what causes that reckoning. And Dalio has said, and if you listen to a podcast I did with recently, especially with Kevin Stewart, there has to be an event. There has to be a major change in the underlying narrative that causes people to actually start to sell. We've not really seen that yet in a big way. Interestingly, We have seen a lot of the former high flyers come down. We've seen cryptocurrencies get their butts kicked, in the last year or so. But that's only fed somewhat of a rotation in other areas. So there is a scenario, and I'll be talking to our members about this in the days ahead, where maybe the comeuppance, the belated correction in a lot of the stock market doesn't take everything down with it, but is more of a rotation and rebalancing than it is an overall correction. That remains to be seen, and of course, the Warsh Fed will have a lot to say about it. I think the odds are long, but they're not, they're not non-existent either. So I think that there is some possibility that we have more of a rolling correction, but that other areas benefit from this. Bottom line, I think, in the big picture, though, again, is that we have a situation now with the AI stocks that I've likened to a couple of other incidents in the last couple of decades. Number one is, of course, and these are all caused by Wall Street, generally speaking. In right after the crash and everything settled in 2000, 2002, and 2003, things started to right themselves, and somebody got the bright idea of goosing the mortgage and real estate market. So for several years, you had a situation where, because it seemed like it was easy money returns for capital, an artificial demand beyond what was real world demand for mortgages and real estate materialized, to where mortgage issuance went nuts. Along with that, prices of housing fed by easy mortgages and cheap interest rates, all of that went nuts, to the point where people that should never have had a mortgage, should never have been in a house that they couldn't afford, were, because of financial alchemy. Joe Sixpack didn't get out of bed one morning and say, let's go out and buy a house that's more than we can afford, but we'll take the bank's word for it that we can put no money down, and a variable rate for the early part of it, and here we are in a home. And all those things blew up back then. And it wasn't because Joe Sixpack decided to do it. It was because this was a culture fed by the need of money to make more money that force-fed all of this stupidity that ended up blowing up. That wasn't good enough. Several years later, Wall Street's next bright idea was the shale boom in the energy industry. So now they start force-feeding money into energy companies, loaning all kinds of money because of this miracle of the shale boom. What did that do? That overdid things for that industry. It caused too much production too fast. That caused the price of oil, mostly, and natural gas also, as a consequence, to crash. A lot of companies went belly up because, again, this was not a situation of energy executives getting out of bed and say, let's do something stupid and go out and borrow a lot of money and create more production capacity than there is demand in the market right now. This was fed to them by Wall Street. And in both cases, whether it was Joe Sixpack buying a house he couldn't afford, whether it was a energy executive who went out over his or her skis, all right, the end result was the same. You were engaging activity that was unnatural, where there was no legitimate organic economic demand, and it ended badly. I think AI is outdoing both of those. I'll be doing some separate stuff on AI in a not too distant future, pointing out all of the reasons, and I alluded to these here and there in conversations for months now, but pointing out kind of all in one place all the reasons why the outlooks, the promises made by companies, the promises made by politicians, cannot physically, economically, financially, or otherwise even happen in a lot of cases. And I think when this reckoning comes, you'd better look out below when it comes to the stock market overall. Just like the internet, I'm not saying AI is all bad. I'm not saying there isn't some utility for it. But it's been overpromised, overinvested in, and again, because this is the latest bit of financial alchemy, the people who are in the know, people with the best connections are using to make all kinds of paper profits. And, you know, they think that like in the past, they'll find a chair when the music stops and let everybody else hold the bag. We'll see what happens. Last but not least on my concerns still about the stock market, and I've, you know, clearly been like some other people, a little bit premature. I'm thinking the stock market's going to have more trouble. So, you know, we still have got modest positions in inverse ETFs. They'll probably increase those at some point. But, you know, that's ballast right now, which isn't doing us a hell of a lot of good. But the other thing I think that's going to change the narrative potentially, and not in a good way, is going to come during the midterm elections. I think President Trump is living in a fantasy world. The only thing, and I've said this again recently, that the Republican Party generally has going for is that the Democrats are no better than they are when you look at their agenda. But look, if the Democrats win one or both houses in the Congress this year, I think the stock market is going to sour considerably, because a big part of the reason why it's done so well, and, you know, the president himself has been goosing it. The president's making all these promises. And for most everybody, you know, the path of least resistance is to, you know, as I said in another one of the cartoons I had Jerry do for me recently, you know, Dr. Strange Bull, you know, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bubbles. Love the bull market that was, you know, increasingly got just air underneath it. I think that if those who have gone, and as usual recently, we've got record levels of margin debt, record levels of hedge fund borrowings from the Fed. I mean, this is a bull market that has been built on leverage and hopium. And again, on top of all these other things that we're concerned about right now, as we get near election day, if things are looking worse for the president, I think that a lot of people are going to say, hey, we had our fun, but we better get while the getting is good, because all we're going to have if the Democrats run things on Capitol Hill is investigations and impeachments and not a hell of a lot getting done and a lot of bad blood. No one's going to want to hang around for that. So if no other reason, this is really another indication that if Americans, and this is what pretty much always happens, if everybody votes their pocketbook, the Republicans are not going to do well, and they're going to get punished for the president and his policies. And especially when President Trump recently has just made idiotic comments about it. Now he loves inflation. And then he'll switch from that and say, well, affordability is not a problem. Well, there's well over half this country living paycheck to paycheck without big portfolios full of AI stocks. They don't see the picture that the president's painting. And the more he runs his mouth talking about how we've got the greatest economy in the history of the solar system, the more I think it's going to come back and bite Republicans. So that's another thing I'm looking for as we get toward the midterms. If things don't start getting better for the president and his party, you're not going to want to hang around. Wrapping up, I want to make a few quick comments about the precious metals and really base metals too. On the latter, base metals and a lot of other commodities, and I've mentioned this, I think, a time or two recently, a bit later in the summer, I'm going to be settled up north for the duration here soon, and I'll be able to regroup and get ready to put out another couple of macro pieces. The next one you'll see will be on the theme of the new fangs. Some of you have heard that before. Of course, the old fangs were Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. The new fangs going forward for what I still believe will be a long-term secular bull market for commodities. Those new fangs are fuels, agriculture, aerospace and defense, N is for nuclear energy, G is for gold and other metals. And with most of those things, you got common denominators of not enough supply going forward for increasing demand of all different kinds. And some commodities and metals particularly are more sensitive to this than others. I'll save that story for later. But on the precious metals, I found it comical recently, and I say this often. I've got a lot of friends who are way more religious about precious metals than I am. I'm a bit more practical and therefore have a much better track record than most of them do because, you've heard the old saying that when all you have is a hammer, everything is a nail. Well, if you're too religious as a gold bug, you start with the supposition that gold has to go up, and then you look for the narrative to try and rationalize that, even if you have to make it up. Part of that recently was there was a number of people who were claiming that President Trump or someone in his cabinet had up their sleeve this idea that on our 250th birthday, there was going to be a July 4th revaluation of gold. I saw this in several places, and I laughed every time I saw it because it's just as asinine on its face, and of course, it didn't happen. Don't forget, folks, that where gold is concerned, and these same people are all trying to pick the bottom, and I'm going to talk about that here in just a second. But look, if you marked to market all of the gold that the U.S. is purported to have, and I'll say purported, we don't know what's there. Every now and then, it's been suggested there'll be an audit of Fort Knox or the New York Fed or whoever has supposedly got physical custody of what gold reserves the U.S. does have. I don't know if it's there or not. In my opinion, it doesn't make a whole hell of a lot of difference because we're in a different world today, notwithstanding what gold bugs think we should be in. But if you took all of that gold that we're supposed to have and market to market, you will cover 6 months' worth of interest of the deficit this year. You're not going to pay down debt. You're not going to do anything. And that's if you were able to sell all of that gold for 4,200 or whatever, 4,100 an ounce, which you're not going to do if you try and sell it all at once. So it's just silly stuff. But look, I said back when the Iran war started, and many of you remember this, that gold was going to go down as a result of the war, not up. Why is that? A lot of reasons. A lot of the generalist investors who chased gold, got into the momentum late last year into early this year, got whipsawed, they got run out of gold, and they're not coming back until the narrative changes. And in the podcast that I did of Your Money Today called This Is Still Not Your Father's Gold Market, I explained the narrative. And I've explained it on others' podcasts since then. What has to happen for gold to resume its move higher? The good news is that in the recent past, I've seen signs of underlying strength, even though we've seen a couple of instances where briefly the price had a three handle for gold. We dipped just a bit on a spot price under 4,000 an ounce, but then went back above it. Now we're going back in the wrong direction again because of the move higher in interest rates and the move higher in gold. So the good things I've seen have been that even though in the last couple of weeks we were lower on the gold price than we were in the first big washout, like in late March timeframe, many of the equities are higher now in price than they were back at the end of March. So those have firmed up, and I think that if we've seen the end, or damn near close to it, for gold's price decline itself, then the damage is pretty much done now where the equities are concerned. I still think that there's a scenario where you go lower. I'll talk about that in a moment. But before I do, the other good, healthy thing I've seen recently, and I've mentioned this on a few of my more recent updates that I put out and video profiles of some of our recommended companies. And I pointed out where they're concerned, and a couple of them are shining examples themselves, that any good project that deserves money, deserves financing, has no trouble this year raising money. And that's almost counterintuitive to, the gold price itself dropping about $1,500 or so, top to bottom. but you've got a lot smarter and stronger hands that want in on what they still understand, whatever happens in the near term, what they still understand is a long-term secular move that will resume when that narrative I've talked about numerous times changes. That said, you'll remember, and I've shared this with you a few times in the recent past, that I looked at two different chart points on gold. One around 4,400, and the other was last summer's breakout around 3,500. And I said, we're going to at least get to the first one, if not to the second one, eventually. The third one could be about where we bottomed recently, because there was another chart point that I'm sharing in the next issue of the National Investor for our members, where you had another kind of narrowing channel for the gold price that broke out right at around 4,000, which was after last summer's breakout from 3,500. That's conceivable. What would that take? It would take, sooner rather than later, Kevin Warsh kind of admitting that he's limited as to what he can do on fighting inflation, or some other event that forces the Fed's hand to abandon this altogether and just say, hey, you know, we're back to inflate or die again. I don't know that that's going to happen, and that's why near term my attitude is still the same on gold and on silver, which got down to its target that I had for it in a hell of a hurry. Its price has been cut in half pretty much from the high. But where they're concerned, my attitude is basically that this is still an environment that you've got to be cautious. And if you followed my advice late last year and into the beginning of this year, and you've got a lot of dry powder, no reason you can't start redeploying some of that now, building back positions on maybe some companies you sold down, some stocks you sold down, some news stories. I've been adding a few news stories recently, got a few more on tap over the summer months. But sector-wise, there's still enough reasons why we still go back to 3,500 on gold. And now you've got to wonder about whether silver, already down to the 50s, could conceivably go lower. I mean, it shouldn't technically, but who knows? And I'll have something to say in our newsletter shortly about that as well. Now, last but certainly not least in the grand scheme of things for the long term, look, I still love copper long term. I still love uranium long term. I still love a lot of commodities long term. Let me leave you, and again, I'm going to be talking about a lot of these things and other commodities in greater detail in my new fangs and other upcoming things you'll see over the course of the summer. But let me leave you right now with one statistic that Jeff Curry, who these days is with Carlyle, of course, for a lot of years, he was Goldman Sachs' big commodities guru, one of the smartest commodities people on planet Earth. Another guy I listen to when it comes to this ridiculous disconnect between the paper markets for energy and what's really going on the ground. I put a lot of faith in what he says. I've shared a lot of his stuff with you, those of you who are in our audience, especially on social media. But I'll leave you with one statistic that he has cited recently. If you look, and this is very recent, if you look at the S&P 500 overall, the portion of the S&P 500 that's technology, and specifically AI and all the different appurtenances of that, technically, you know, the chip companies, etc., 50% of the S&P 500 is those kind of companies. That's 50% of the overall market cap. If you take the totality of energy and metals commodities and all the companies that process those and are involved in those, it's a grand total of 6% of the S&P 500. Now, among the reasons why that's just Looney Tunes is that you cannot have a sustainable industry for AI that will meet all of the promises that have been made, or even a majority of them, without much healthier industries and higher prices for copper and uranium and natural gas, and now even having to bring a lot of coal back online because there's just not enough energy for these things. Now, I'm skeptical that we're going to see AI develop to the extent it's been promised. I would pretty much guarantee that it won't. Again, as I alluded to a few minutes ago, I'll explain that in the near future as well. But even if we get some of it, and even aside from all of that, when you look at just infrastructure needs, when you look at the needs, especially here in the U.S., to bolster and update our power grid, which is a mess, as we've learned again recently in parts of the country with this heat wave of the recent past. All of these commodities were bullish before the whole AI flim-flam became a part of this story. So look, I think long-term these are all good, actionable things, but as with the rest of asset classes out there, so-called risk assets, the stock market and otherwise, I think a bad situation near term could be made worse if Fed Chair Kevin Warsh follows through with his claim that he's going to bring back price stability and bring back the credibility of the Fed to actually get inflation back down to its 2% target, which it hasn't hit in God knows how long now, been 5 or 6 years, and he wants to fix that. And near term, that's not healthy for anything because, again, and I'm not saying we're going to get this kind of a washout in this magnitude necessarily. The pattern will be the same. The magnitude might not. But if you go back to 2008 when a lot of these credit things unraveled, I don't care what it was, everything went down. Gold went down. Copper went down. Energy went down. Energy went down huge, like I alluded to a few minutes ago, etc. It's a different world right now. It's going to evolve differently, but again, the pattern will be the same. So just like it's still a yellow caution light for precious metals, it's still a yellow caution light sector-wise for most commodities that I follow. But here again, it is a time that as long as you're keeping your portfolio balance fairly conservative, you still can be putting money in some of the better stories long term. And of course, I've interviewed a few people recently that are among my favorites. You'll be seeing more of those over the balance of the summer as well. So I guess that's it for now, not to ramble on anymore. I continue to be very jaded about the prospect for most things going into the second half of the year, as I've been, and even more so with the midterms coming up. With still, I think, the big picture of the fallout of the Iran war still ahead of us, more than in the rearview mirror, even if all of these, you know, finally the 40-somethings time that the president promised that we're actually going to have some kind of a legitimate peace deal with Iran, you're still talking about a long time to fix this stuff. A lot of stuff on Main Street, not in the markets where paper oil gives you a false sense of security, but underneath that, there's still a lot of damage, there's still a lot of inflation pressures, there's still a lot of supply pressures going forward. All of these things are going to be reckoned with at some point. And you've got to look over your shoulder and see when these things are coming. Better still, make sure from the get-go that you're out of harm's way. So thanks for tuning in. Enjoy your summer. I'll be with you from time to time during the summer. And of course, with our members regularly, as I always try to be.
We're glad you joined us today. As always, write to chris@nationalinvestor.com with your comments and questions. And be sure to visit yourmoneytoday.org if you haven't already. Sign up for our free alerts, notifications of new shows, and more. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.